Today at Reader's Corner, Pamela Rottner Sakamoto, author of Midnight in Broad Daylight, A Japanese-American Family Caught Between Two Worlds. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. It's been more than 70 years since the atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, Japan, ushering in the end of World War II. Yet true stories such as the one from today's guest, Pamela Rottner Sakamoto, remind us how much history still has to teach us and why personal accounts remain so powerful. Dr. Sakamoto is the author of Midnight in Broad Daylight, A Japanese-American Family Caught Between Two Worlds. As the title suggests, it is the story of a family with deep ties to both Japan and America caught in the crosshairs of war. When Japanese bombers swept low over Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941, part of the Fukuhara family was living in the United States, the rest in Japan. Two sons were drafted into the Japanese Imperial Army, and another enlisted in the U.S. Army as a bilingual interpreter. Family members on both sides of the Pacific felt the weight of the war as deprivation deepened for Japanese civilians and Japanese Americans living on the west coast of the United States were evacuated to internment camps in the country's interior. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Pamela Sakamoto. She is a scholar of Japanese-American relations and is fluent in both Japanese and English. She joins us via Skype from Honolulu for this interview. Aloha, Pamela Rottner Sakamoto, and welcome to Reader's Corner.
I'm so happy to speak with you.
Pamela, when my wife was reading your book, she kept interrupting me anyway and saying, I don't believe this is real. I feel like I'm reading a novel. I feel as though this couldn't possibly all have happened to one family. And in some ways, I guess it's magical that you were even able to write this book because it was all on the basis of a chance encounter with Harry Fukuhara, who you met years ago. Could you tell us how that came about and your friendship with Harry over the years?
I met Harry Fukuhara in Tokyo in 1994 by chance. I had just moved there and was attending a press conference for former Jewish refugees who had received life-saving visas from a Japanese diplomat in Lithuania during World War II. And they had escaped the Holocaust via Japan. I was there to hear their stories. It was related to my dissertation. And Harry was assisting at the press conference as a favor to a friend. I was taken by him. He was able to move among different groups, Japanese diplomats who were there to address the conference and these former Jewish refugees. He was clearly bilingual, which was and still strikes me as an amazing thing to be that bilingual in English and Japanese. And he was so poised and dignified. But I didn't think too much more of that encounter. And I happened to say to a filmmaker with this group, these refugee stories are amazing. I mean, they had harrowing escapes from Europe, and it was amazing that they had reached Japan. And she said to me, if you think their stories are incredible, you should talk to Harry. And that was my first inkling that Harry had an extraordinary story of his own. I did not talk to him about his own family history at that point. But we struck up a sort of friendship, and he ended up contacting me several times a year when he would travel from his home in San Jose, where he was retired, to Tokyo. And he would meet me for lunch. And over the course of 4 years, he gradually told me his story. And finally, in 1998, I said to him, gee, Harry, you know, this is really remarkable, and I think you should consider leaving a record for your family, for your generation, for the Japanese-American community, and for U.S.-Japan relations. And the next day, introduced me to his brothers, and we were off and running.
So this really wouldn't be a story were it not for Harry's father, Katsuji, who left Japan in 1900, arrives in Seattle, I believe, Auburn, Washington. Tell us about why was there a large emigration out of Japan at that time? Why did his father come to the United States in the first place?
Yes, there was a large flow of Japanese emigrants to the West Coast. In the late 1800s, the U.S. railroad industry was actually recruiting young men from Japan to work on the railroads to the West. And Harry's father was a second son in a poor family in Hiroshima Prefecture. And Hiroshima Prefecture actually sent a huge number of emigrants to the United States. The Japanese workers on the railroad were replacing the Chinese, who had already been excluded by immigration laws. The Japanese would experience the same thing, but there was this window of opportunity from the late 1800s to the early 1900s when there was a flow of young men followed by a flow of picture brides who married them, including Harry's mother, Kinu, who married Katsuji and arrived in Seattle in 1911.
Explain the picture bride process to us. How does that work? His father's sitting home in Auburn, Washington, and just sends for photos and then decides which to invite over, and do they have any, do the young women have anything to say about it? How does that work?
Well, it's really an arranged marriage, and it was something that was very comfortable for families because whether they were near or far in Japan, arranged marriages were the established institution. And so families would, through a middleman, communicate with each other and try to find somebody of the appropriate economic class and background. And Kinu was from a very large family that had seen hard times, and she was one of many daughters. And they had a pedigree, as Katsuji's family did, but they needed a groom for her. And so it was arranged. She was a very obedient daughter. What she thought about this arrangement, I do not know, but she did have an elder brother who was already in the United States, so it wasn't something completely foreign to the family, she would still keep in close contact with her family in Hiroshima Prefecture.
What I had not really focused on, Pamela, when I was reading your book and thinking about what kind of trials and tribulations these new Japanese Americans faced in America, was the alien land laws. Help us understand how prohibitive it was for these Japanese families to really make a living, given the fact that these land laws, which I guess were state laws, were in their way.
Okay, so in the context of the story, Kinu does arrive in Seattle only knowing her husband by a photograph, and he only knows her by a photograph, but they have high hopes. He has already achieved some white-collar success, and is working with a trading company and has all kinds of entrepreneurial interests. She is very excited about the prospect, and they settle and think that through the Japanese farming community, they can achieve even greater success. But what happens over time is that in California and the state of Washington, laws are enacted at the state level to deprive Japanese of the opportunity to own land. First of all, they can't even become citizens. Their children, if they're born in the U.S., will become citizens, but the immigrants will not. And so they lose the opportunity to own land, and they end up becoming tenant farmers. And it will affect, in a ripple way, Katsuji as well, who depends upon these Japanese farmers for his livelihood of selling insurance and hiring workers and things like that. But it's a very restrictive way for the Japanese to live, and it's a downward slope.
You're listening to Reader's Corner, and I'm talking today with Pamela Rottner Sakamoto. She is the author of a new book, Midnight in Broad Daylight, A Japanese-American Family Caught Between Two Worlds. So as I said in the introduction, this is clearly a family divided. Tell us how this family gets split up.
So Katsuji is able, through his great people skills, to bridge the divide between the Japanese and the American community. And he has American business contacts as well. And he's holding on during the Great Depression. But then in 1933, he falls ill and dies of pleurisy at a young age. And his widow, Kinu, has five American-born children. And she sees no way to stay financially in the United States. And she takes her children back to Hiroshima. where her family will help her out, and her life insurance proceeds will go much further because the cost of living is lower. However, two of those children are so adamant that they do not belong in Japan that they make their mom promise that when they graduate high school in Japan, they will return to the United States. And those two are Mary, the only girl, and Harry, the middle son. Mary stays in Japan, so from 1933 to about 1936, and then goes back alone, which is quite a bold move from a young unmarried woman. Harry goes back in 1938 when he's 18, and he believes that he will be able to resume his life that he left, but he receives a very chilly welcome.
Maybe I've mixed up the children and their ages, but didn't the mother and father send Mary back like as early as 1923 when she was 7 years old to live with an aunt?
Yeah, so, I mean, there are really two families involved. They're one family of five children, but they've been raised separately. Mary originally, with Victor, the two eldest children, are sent back when they're in elementary school to live with the mother's sister, with their aunt Kyo. And Kino sends them and to live with her sister Kyo. And the idea is that there is so much discrimination, not just the land laws, but also even if a Japanese American is able to graduate from college and seek a job, that the employment environment is so anti-Japanese that if a Japanese American has both skills in English and Japanese, that the job prospects will be better when he or she returns to the United States. So it actually becomes institutionalized. Japanese parents send their Japanese American children back to Japan for several years or more to learn Japanese and Japanese ways. And then the hope is that when they return, they'll acclimate to the United States again and be able to use both of those skills. So Mary and Victor have had that experience. And so Mary has come back in the late 1920s to Seattle, to Auburn. And then when her dad dies in 1933, her mother takes her back to Japan again. So she's already been in Japan and in the United States and feels that she really doesn't belong in either place. But if there's one place that she's more comfortable, it's the United States. Harry has never been to Japan when his mom takes the kids back in 1933. And he feels that it's utterly foreign and he can't wait to get back to the United States.
So let's talk about Harry, who is really the main character in the book, even though you've covered the lives of the other four siblings. After his move to Japan, his schooling in Japan apparently was in stark contrast to what he experienced in the U.S. Tell us about how he fares back in Japan.
Well, he's sort of the class clown in the U.S. He has tons of friends. He loves his life. He feels just the same as his neighbor next door who has the last name Ferguson, totally at home. And then when he goes to Japan, he feels adrift. He looks Japanese, but he doesn't act particularly Japanese. He has never really studied Japanese well. He's resisted his parents' attempts to send him to Japanese language school. He's attended, but he has failed to learn. So he is assigned to the second grade when he's 13 of the local Japanese school. He quits, and his mom has to hire him a tutor, and then she finds a school that has a large Japanese-American population, where some of the courses are initially actually taught in English. He makes close friends with Japanese-Americans. He still does not like Japan. And even in this school, which is more benevolent for Japanese-Americans, there are drills for a kind of JROTC. So the military presence is very strong, and anti-American sentiment in Hiroshima is very strong.
So how old is he when he finally gets out of Japan and back to America?
He's 18. He graduates high school, and almost as soon as he can, he goes right back.
And tell us about his experience. Now he's back in the United States, and this is the really tough part because, of course, this is when internment is occurring. And where now do the Fukuhara family find themselves?
Right, so he goes back to the Auburn area expecting to resume his life. He's largely rejected. Nobody recognizes the value of a Japanese high school degree. He can't afford to go to college. He ends up becoming sort of a day laborer, a migrant worker, and works his way down south to Los Angeles. And by the time of Pearl Harbor in 1941, he is going to night school. He's living with an employer. He's working as a gardener. He is aspiring. And then with Pearl Harbor, everything changes literally overnight. He's fired from his gardening job on the spot. Curfews are put in place. Anti-Japanese sentiment is now absolutely palpable. And he knows that he's going to be interned. It's imminent. He keeps changing neighborhoods to live in the Los Angeles area, hoping to outrun the internment, but it does happen.
So he's at the camp and trying to figure out how to get out of there. Tell us how he manages to fight his way out of that internment camp.
So he does end up entering camp, actually, with his sister and her young child. His sister Mary was in Seattle. She joins him in Los Angeles, so he's not alone. He is also with very close Japanese-American friends with whom he had been in Hiroshima, so they have these long and intimate ties. But he finds himself becoming so embittered in Gila River in Arizona as a young man. So in 1942, at this point, he's 22. He sees no future. College has disappeared for him. He is holding a job in the camp, but he has no idea when they will be released. No one knows. And he sees an opportunity to take a test for the incipient Military Intelligence Service as a bilingual linguist to translate captured documents and to possibly interrogate Japanese POWs. And he signs up on a whim because he's just so disgusted in camp. And he passes the test immediately and ends up enlisting in the U.S. Army.
Now, Parallel Lives, tell us about one of his brothers, who I believe is at least one of his brothers who's in the Japanese Imperial Army. And how close did these two come to actually being in the same theater of war, obviously on different sides?
Well, when Harry entered the Army, he knew that because of his brother's ages, it was likely that they were in the Japanese Army. But he sort of blocked that out of his mind. He didn't think he was going to the Pacific anyway. When he left Japan, his eldest brother, Victor, was already in the Army. He was within Japan, but Harry was able to visit him. And then while Harry was in the United States and interned, his brother Pierce would be drafted into the Japanese Imperial Army, and eventually his youngest and really closest brother, Frank, would be as well. But after Pearl Harbor, shortly after, Harry had lost touch with his family in Japan, so he was really operating with limited knowledge.
I'm Bob Kustra, host of Reader's Corner, and I'm speaking with Pamela Sakamoto about her new book, Midnight in Broad Daylight. The book is the account of a Japanese-American family caught in the crosshairs of World War II. So let's talk about the Hiroshima atomic bomb and it's dropped. And where was Harry at the time? He was in Manila, I believe, wasn't he?
Yes. So Harry ends up island hopping through the Southwest Pacific. And all the time that he's gradually approaching Japan, he's thinking about his brothers. What if? And he does have this sort of stunning encounter in New Guinea with someone he knows from Hiroshima who's on the opposite side. And so that really brings home the possibility that he might encounter his brothers at war. And in Manila in the summer of 45, he's facing the prospect of invading Japan with the first wave of forces in November 1945, when an invasion larger than Normandy is slated. And it is excruciating for him. He requests leave. It is denied because he has made himself so valuable as a linguist by this point that he is considered essential. And he doesn't know what's going to happen. Meanwhile, his younger brothers, Pierce and Frank, are indeed in the Japanese Imperial Army. And they are on the southern island of Kyushu in Japan, the very island that Harry is slated to invade.
Oh my gosh, that's quite a coincidence if there ever was one. So Harry knows that his mother and brothers are in Hiroshima and this atomic bomb goes off. Harry is in charge of some Japanese prisoners of war, and he has to figure out a way to tell them what has happened. And yet, how do you explain an atomic bomb that no one yet knows exactly what it is?
The information was so limited, right? I mean, Harry was down the food chain of the military. He
sure.
only knew the kind of information that he was provided. And people were just calling it, in both countries, a new bomb because they didn't know how to describe it. And so he just gave these prisoners of war the basic statistics. And of course, at the same time, he's thinking, oh my, what has happened to my family? And the information that is trickling in is incomplete and it's dire. And it's basically that Hiroshima has ceased to exist and that nothing will grow there for 75 years.
And so Harry decides he's going to find out how his mother and his brothers are doing. Tell us how he accomplishes that. Tell us about his brother in particular, because that obviously hasn't gone well as a result of the bombing itself.
So in September of 1945, Harry lands in Japan with the 33rd Infantry Division, and he is based in Kobe, which is several hundred miles away. But he asks his commanding officer, for whom he is the direct interpreter, if he can go and find his family. And he receives permission. He loads up a jeep. Twice he fails to reach Hiroshima because the roads are so bad and there are typhoons and it's just inaccessible. And on the third time, he succeeds. When he reaches his home, he doesn't know what to expect. The house is still standing, which heartens him because he's gone through a decimated Hiroshima city. His mother looks aged and unwell, but his eldest brother, Victor, is upstairs on a futon with a burned back. And he can talk, and he does not complain, but Harry is chilled by the image. It's an image that haunts him for the rest of his life. He looks away from his back, and he talks to his brother, and they both try to keep some level of normalcy. Of course, they haven't seen each other since 1938, and the unimaginable has happened, truly unimaginable, and this will be between them. But Victor never, ever talks about the bomb, and Victor will eventually pass away.
Harry, in the meantime, led a wonderful life and a long life after these many difficult encounters over time. He was honored by both Japan and the United States. Tell us about his rank and what he did with the rest of his life.
Okay, so Harry ends up going back to the United States in 1946. And he leaves his family in Japan. He has to go back with fellow U.S. Army troops from the 33rd Division. And he struggles initially. And then he decides, for some very compelling reasons in the book, to go back to Japan. And the only way to go back to Japan, which is a vanquished country with no foreign relations, it's totally occupied, is to rejoin the Army. And the Army ends up being Harry's career. And he becomes one of the first Japanese-American colonels, breaks the glass ceiling for the next generation, and we have many Japanese-American generals in our Army now. And he becomes a legend in military intelligence circles. In December of this year, the 500th Military Intelligence Brigade at Schofield Barracks in Oahu named its new headquarters Harry Fukuhara Hall. I can't tell you how resonant that is, because Schofield was strafed by Japanese heroes en route to Pearl Harbor. And the idea that this intelligence headquarters for the Pacific would name its permanent location after a Japanese-American who was interned and then provided legendary service for about 50 years is incredibly meaningful. In military circles, he is known as the man whose mission succeeded. And he just provided really dogged and tireless service to his country. At the same time, it was also for Japan. He spent most of that time in Japan, and he became a bridge between the two countries. And all the way up to the prime ministerial level in Japan, he had contacts. And I believe that he is one reason that the U.S.-Japan alliance is so strong today.
Well, what's so amazing about the entire story, and Harry's story in particular, but his brother's as well, and Mary, is the extreme depredation that this family suffered over time in so many different ways. And they never gave up hope. They never lost hope. They remained committed, patriotic to their country, countries, you might even say. I don't know where you find anything like that in this world we live in today.
I do think it's remarkable, but I also think it's very representative of the Japanese-American response to the war. I mean, the internment stripped them of their property, their livelihoods, their sense of dignity, their sense of belonging. Some people were never able to regain their footing, and yet you do find this great patriotism and immense goodwill. And certainly, you know, the families, there are other families who experienced this divided state, and there are other families who lost loved ones to the atomic bomb. And yet, the desire to go on and the desire to make the best of those tragedies, to turn them around and try to prevent anything from ever happening again, is really affirming and inspiring.
It's clearly a book about character. There's no question. Now, again, there's only so much time, and I urge our listeners to pick this book up because I'm doing the Cliff Notes approach here, trying to cover as much as I can. But tell us, if you could, just sum up his brother, who Harry was very close to. Is that Frank? The one he was very close. Was that Frank?
Yes, yeah. Frank is his younger brother. Frank also succeeds. He ends up able to dust off his English and to develop a business and to take advantage in a positive way of Japan's resurgence as an economy in the post-war period. Frank does something very striking as well. He loses his American citizenship because of his service in the Japanese Imperial Army. And when he reapplies, he is rejected. It takes him decades to regain it. And when he receives the letter, he makes a decision. He could easily have dual citizenship for Japan and the United States. And he's living in a safe time. But he decides that although he's too old to return to the U.S. and make a go of it professionally, because all he has in the U.S. is an elementary school education, he loves the United States. And he gives up his Japanese citizenship, takes the American citizenship, and lives the rest of his life in Japan as a foreigner on his wife's visa. His wife is Japanese, so he receives a visa through her citizenship. And I think that's quite a statement. He said that he never wanted to be divided by two countries again, and this was his way to ensure it.
Wow, that's quite a story. We could end it there, but I want you to share with us just how close Harry and Frank came to reading this book, but they didn't.
Oh, no, this is one of the sadder aspects for me. I mean, I worked on it so long. It was so hard to bring it to publication for many reasons, and I hoped and dreamed that they would see the book, and I know that they felt the same way. But I was dealing with elderly people when I began the book. They were extremely sharp for extremely long, but, you know, they did age, and this took years. And Frank passed away at first, and in a very Japanese way, he did not tell Harry, he did not tell his relatives in the United States or me that he was ailing. He didn't want to trouble anyone. And so we sort of heard all of a sudden that he was very ill, and then he died. And so he did not see the book. He knew that it was going to be published. He knew the publication date. He knew the title. But I wish that he had been able to see it. Harry died a few months later. In a way, I think that Harry was always trying to take care of Frank and waited as long as he could, and then he passed. And Harry knew the cover was about to come out. He knew the book was definitely going to be published, that it had been edited, you know, it was in its final stages of production, but neither of them saw it. But I believe that the knowledge alone that it was going to happen, that people would learn their story, was gratifying to them.
Absolutely. Well, Pamela, this has just been a great interview. I so much appreciate your taking the time to do it. The name of the book is Midnight in Broad Daylight, A Japanese-American Family Caught Between Two Worlds. Pamela Rottner Sakamoto, thank you for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thank you, Bob. It's been a delight.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Pamela Rottner Sakamoto. Next week, Lynn Schur, author of Sally Ride, America's First Woman in Space. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research and production by Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner. If you've missed some of our previous interviews, you can listen to them anytime on our free player. You'll find it at the iTunes App Store and Google Play. Just search for Reader's Corner.